And of course, our special guest tonight, Kevin Mitnick. In this hour, we'll take your phone calls with him on Coast to Coast AM. Kevin, what do you recommend? What tips for the person who owns a computer, you know, maybe orders online, does some banking online? What do you recommend they just simply do? How can they take care of themselves?
Well, one of the first things I would do is use what I believe is a more secure browser. It doesn't mean you're 100% safe, but I prefer like Google Chrome over like Internet Explorer, for example. So I think that Google has done a good job. That doesn't mean there hasn't been security vulnerabilities found in the past, but I actually like the speed at which Google fixes problems that have been found. Example, when you're in coffee shops or even Starbucks, rather than using open Wi-Fi directly, you could probably find a VPN service for 10, 15 bucks a month. And VPN stands for Virtual Private Network.
Mm-hmm.
So what you do is you connect to the virtual private network service you signed up for, and then basically everything you're doing is in an encrypted tunnel. So even if there's an eavesdropper at Starbucks or Coffee Bean or in the United Airlines lounge at the airport, they're not going to be able to eavesdrop on some of your data. One of my favorite things, though, is a lot of people use like free email services like Hotmail, Yahoo, Gmail.
Sure, yeah.
Well, what's really cool about Gmail is they have a new service called two-step authentication.
What's that?
So if you have like a BlackBerry, an Android, or an iPhone, you could download this app. And what it does is it changes, it's an app that displays like a token, like a code, a six-digit code, and it changes every 60 seconds. So to log into your Gmail account, you put in your username, you put in your password, and you put in the code that's displayed at that moment. And this is what they call two-form factor authentication, because it's something you know, a password, and then kind of like something you have, which is a token that displays the six-digit code.
Which you can only see on your phone, right?
Which you see on your phone, and then you could log into your Gmail account. Now, this is a fantastic service for absolutely free. It's like almost like having enterprise security, because now if somebody phishes your password or tricks you into getting your password or has malicious software installed on your computer that steals your password, they still don't have the code that's necessary to get in.
What's the motivation for stealing your emails and your email passwords? I mean, what do they want? Most of the time, the stuff is personal little junk, right?
Well, they could reset passwords. Like, for example, if you're, you know, signed up with a lot of services, even your bank, once somebody has control of your email, they can do a password reset, right? And reset your password to different services, or maybe get what they, you know, private information like your credit card number, your social security number, you know, kind of like identity theft type purposes.
Interesting.
So, you know, so definitely email is a target. One area that hackers are looking at to exploit you is more on the exploiting security flaws with software found on your desktop, like Adobe Acrobat, Adobe Flash, your browser, Java, for example. And a lot of people are lazy and don't keep the software up to date. So there's a company called Sukuna that has a program called Personal Software Inspector for absolutely free. And what that program does is it looks at the software you have on your desktop. They don't have all the software. They don't check all of it, you know, but they check the most popular ones. And if it's out of date, they'll tell you about it so you could install the latest version, so you'll be less likely to be exploited.
All right. Go ahead,
and
Kevin.
One more thing, if I could say.
Absolutely.
People tend to use the same password for multiple purposes, for their bank, for their email, you know, and for other things. And this is one of the vulnerabilities that LulzSec had exploited, is they found one guy that was using the same password for everything.
Yeah, it's smart to change it, isn't it?
No, it's smart to use like a password manager, so you keep different passwords everywhere, but you only have to remember one. And like one of the free ones, you know, there's free ones out there, PasswordSafe, KeePass, Password Gorilla. There's, you know, lots of options to choose from. And that way, if your password is compromised in one location, the hacker can't leverage that information to get into everything else you have.
Good point. Let's go to the phones. We'll go to Ithaca, New York to start. First-time caller. Adam, you're on Coast to Coast with Kevin Mitnick.
Good morning, gentlemen. How are we doing today?
Fine. Great. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing real well, thanks. George, I just want to say I love the show. I listen to you every night, six nights a week, and
Thank you.
Get me through sometimes.
Thank you.
I had a quick question. Kevin, you had mentioned something about jailbreaking iPhones and the heightened level of the security risks that it poses. I have an iPhone, and I jailbroke my iPhone. And
You jailbreak your iPhone, you should definitely, in fact, a close friend of mine just had this problem, is you should definitely change your root password because the default password is Alpine. So if you're ever at an open wireless network, for example, and people are looking for iPhones that have SSH installed, then it's easy to, you know, compromise your iPhone because you have the default root password.
Okay, great. You nailed it right on the head. That's exactly what I was going to ask, is what is the security risk of jailbreaking it, and what can I do to further protect it? So that's awesome. Thank you so much.
Yeah, there's actually 2 years. One's called mobile and one's called root. Change them both, you know, and it's a very easy to do. And hopefully that helped you. Thank you for calling.
Great. Thank you so much. Great show, guys. Thanks a bunch. Have a great day.
Okay. Sure thing. What percent do you think of folks out there using computers now? 80%?
No. God, probably more. I have no idea what the percentage is, but I mean, computers are an integral part of our lives. I mean, they're just everywhere. And as technology is evolving, it breeds more complexity, which of course breeds more security failures.
All right, next up, let's go to Houston, Texas. Kathleen, east of the Rockies. Hi, Kath.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Morning.
I have a question about electronic checks. Some jerk faces went into my checking account and sold $788, which I didn't have, and charged it to Walmart and went out and bought tons and tons and tons of stuff. Luckily, I caught it within an hour of it happening. I just happened to call my account, which I call every day, just to see if the little $25 is still there. But I called the bank and freaked out, and they said, well, we have to let it go through the whole day. You'll get charged for overdraft and all that, blah, blah, blah. And then tomorrow we'll negate the whole thing. But what I want to know is, how does it happen, and why does it keep happening to other people? Because a friend of mine is a cab driver, and one of his passengers said it happened to her, and they also went to Walmart and did the same thing. So,
one method that could be used is attackers can gain access to a victim's online account, and you know how you could view checks? Yeah, you could look at an image of the check. Well, then they could get the routing number and account number.
But I don't have an online account, and I don't use checks anymore.
That's one way that they can get the information. Some people file tax returns, and they want direct deposit, or they're using some sort of direct deposit with some sort of vendor or government agency. And
you mean it can go through my disability check, and they can get it that way?
Well, it depends on the security of where that information is. And they get your routing number, they get your accounting number, and go to town.
They made up a number.
I don't know what happened in your particular case.
I don't know. I mean, they made up a number of the check, and I'll check my checking account. No checks are missing. Everything was fine. So I just don't know how they just picked me.
Or even at the supermarket, somebody could shoulder surf somebody filling out a check. I know you said you don't have checks.
Well, I have them. I just don't use them.
It's easy to look at the logo on the check to find out who the bank is, and then memorize the routing. Well, the routing number, you don't even need to know it because you know the name of the bank. And then just remembering a 9-digit account number, for example, that's easy as pie. And then just going out and defrauding that person, and the person usually doesn't figure it out till at least 30 days later.
Brother, it's evil out there.
Oh, yeah, it sure is. Too much. Too much. Next up, we go to Vancouver, and it's Vinny's turn on the international line. Vinny, take it away.
Hey, George. Hey, Kevin.
Hey.
Hey, Vinny.
How you doing? I just want to ask you a question. I'm not even sure if it's fact or if it's just urban myth, but are you aware of the early hacking attempts into Nortel when they were based out of, Australia. I wanted to say that was...
I thought Nortel was always in Canada, but I might not know the full history. But I'm not familiar with... I'm familiar... You know, myself, I hack DMS switches, which were manufactured by Nortel, but I'm not familiar with the hack on Nortel itself.
I see. Yeah, I was just sort of asking, because I'd always heard that they had some, you know, foreign, you know, lab set up or business interests, and I was fairly sure there was one in Australia. But
I have no idea. I'm sorry.
Yeah, my question was actually that I just sort of heard that possibly that was one of the early targets of Julian Assange before he got, you know, into WikiLeaks and all that, was that that was one of his targets that he actually hacked on. And what always intrigued me was that that was the case, that, you know, that was why wasn't he ever prosecuted for that, because that would seem like pretty...
I have no idea about Julian Assange and Nortel. I never... First time I heard of it is from you, so I wouldn't be able to answer your question. I'm sorry about that.
Okay, let's go to Seattle on our Skype line. How about that for technology, Kev? Dan, go ahead.
Hi, let's go.
Hi, Kevin.
Hi.
Hi. This is really cool to talk to you. I've been a long, long, long time supporter of yous ever since the 90s, around your whole first time arrest. And
Thank you for your support. I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
You are so welcome. My question was, is when I was growing up, I got into computers a lot like you did, and exploration of things maybe I shouldn't have been exploring at the time. But one thing that kind of was a good principle for me growing up was, you know, the hacker ethic and everything that you and Emmanuel Goldstein and other people who were involved in the hacker community back in the 90s and early 80s, that seems to be kind of gone to the wayside. Like that kind of ethic of like, do no harm, you know, don't hurt people, those types of things, you know, don't basically be a bad person, but our driving principle is to kind of explore. That whole ethic seems to have kind of really fallen.
Yeah, right now the trend has been pretty much for profit and dropping docs on companies, and a lot of the old, you know, the trend definitely has changed from the old school hacking of, you know, not doing it for profit, not doing it to cause harm, but more for the exploration. So, you know, I'm with you there.
It seems like 2600 and with you and stuff, you would be a real good guiding principle to the younger kids, because you were for me. And I was just kind of wondering, you know, are you considering, or do you speak a lot about being that kind of guiding principle again for kids who are, you know, might be going down
the wrong path?
Road? Yeah.
Well, I don't really talk to people that are going down the wrong path, because I don't want to be like accused of doing anything with them. But I always encourage people to, now that computer technology is so freely available, and exploitation frameworks like Metasploit and others, and all the books on information security, you don't have to attack companies now. You could set up your own network, your own lab, and attack that and learn from that. Of course, it doesn't have that seduction of adventure, but at least it's going to keep you out of trouble, which is always a good thing.
Kevin, are you happy with your life now?
Yeah, I'm happy. I go around the world doing public speaking and consulting and with the pen testing and working on books. And it's actually, I never thought, you know, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, that I'd be doing this today.
So no.
I'm extremely lucky.
Not at all. You turned a hobby into a business.
Exactly. So, yeah, it's almost like not working. And in fact, when I'm scoping security assessments for customers, I say, well, it's going to take me this amount of time to do this security test. But when it ends up happening, I'm putting in much more time, because I'm such a perfectionist that I want to find everything to help the client, that I a lot of times do that to my detriment, because it's taking more time than I'm being paid for.
Let's go to New Orleans, Louisiana. Hey, Danny, go ahead. You're on with Kevin Mitnick.
Hey, George. Hey, Kevin.
Hey, Danny. How are you?
I'm doing great. Man, you're really taking me back, Kevin. Gosh, with the CNA bureaus and loop lines, met a lot of girls like that.
okay.
I was curious, when you said that when you got into computers, what type of computer did you start hacking with? I started on Atari 65 XE.
Actually, I started on terminals, like VT100 terminals. And the operating system that I was, first hacking was an operating system called RISC-VISC-E that was developed by Digital Equipment Corporation. That was like the predecessor to VAX VMS. So I kind of started off on the mini computers because when my interest started in computers, it was Olivetti terminals and acoustic coupler modems and VIC-20s and Commodore 64s. In the ancient days of technology.
Right. That's it. That's where I was with the Atari, the Commodore 64. I actually got into TRW and got into a little trouble as a miner. And as far as fracking goes, I used to hook up with people through 800 voicemail services. Did you ever get into that, like hacking into system administrator mailboxes?
Yes.
And stuff like that?
Yes, I did that when I was in phone freaking, yes. Like, I remember one company was called Purina, and there was a way to
know them well.
Get into their to their direct inward dialing, to make phone calls and to play with their voice automated system, before voice automation was out there. So, certainly, I'm very familiar with it.
You were trying to get free dog food, weren't you?
No, free cat food.
That's right. So what are you doing these days now? As you go around the country with your consulting business, do you go in with a staff or do you do it by yourself?
I usually have contractors that work with me. I don't have employees. And basically, it depends on the job. And I pick my team. We go in and complete the project. It's kind of like the movie Sneakers. So I handpick the team, or Mission Impossible. So I get an assignment. I handpick the team. I'm actually hands-on because I enjoy doing it. I enjoy compromising systems. It's like a puzzle for me.
I wanted to produce a TV show.
Puzzles.
Kevin, I wanted to produce a TV show called Hackers with periods between all the letters, and they would all stand for something that had to do with computers. And yeah, I was going to call you up as my consultant and pitch all the networks. I thought it would have been a great show.
It would be very interesting. In fact, I get called in on pitches all the time where they want to create like an A team of hackers that are running from the government for a crime they didn't do, and they're out there, helping the public solve hacking related crimes and stuff like that.
Yep, exactly. They stole our idea. We'll be back in a moment. We'll take final phone calls with our friend Kevin Mitnick in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. On our next Coast to Coast program, John Kachupa joins me as we talk about ghost hunters on the trail of mediums, dowsers, and spirit seekers. So get ready for that classic Coast to Coast show. When we come back in just a moment with Kevin Mitnick, we'll take your phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Kevin Mitnick with us. We'll take your final phone calls as well. Kevin, tell us about the book and where is it available?
Well, the book is available in bookstores. You can go to my website, Mitnick, MITNICK, security.com. And I have links to, you can go to several places to buy the book. It's available on Amazon, on Barnes & Noble. It's everywhere. But what's really cool in the book is if you're a hacker or a person that likes solving puzzles, because don't forget, one of the drivers for me for becoming a hacker was my intense desire to solve puzzles and get around obstacles. So I have cryptograms in each chapter. So in each chapter, under the chapter number, is a bunch of gibberish text. And if you solve all these cryptograms, there's 20 questions. And if you read the book, you'll be able to easily answer the 20 questions. I'm in the process of setting up a website to handle this, but temporarily I'm having people email me. And then what I'm going to do is I'm not going to officially promise anything. Then it becomes a contest. But what I plan to do is drop all the names in a hat of whoever solved these cryptograms and then maybe draw out 5, 10 names. You know, I haven't decided yet. And then I have a bunch of evidence that the FBI has given me back, you know, and all their search warrants in the case. And it's like battery packs, amateur radios, cell phones, computer manuals, electronic parts, modems that are sealed in FBI evidence bags with the original fingerprint dust. So what I'm going to do is give those out as kind of memorabilia for people that have been able to solve the cryptograms, you know, for the people that are drawn out of the hat. But I can't promise to give it. I'm just going to say it's highly likely. Otherwise, it becomes a legal contest, and I have to deal with all that red tape. But that's what I plan to do. So if you, so even, you know, even though I think the book is like a catch-me-if-you-can cyber thriller, you won't be bored because you could always solve some cryptograms as you're reading the book.
Okay, to the phones we go. We'll pick it up by going west of the Rockies. Mark in San Leandro, California. Hey, Mark, go ahead. Thanks for holding.
Hi, George. Good show.
Hi.
Kevin, I want to ask you about the vulnerability of smart meters on utilities, but while I was on hold, there was a story about Social Security employees entering a wrong code indicating people were dead who were still alive, stopping their Social Security payments and their checking accounts, leading to what I guess you could call it an out-of-money experience.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a real bummer to be declared dead by the government.
Yeah, and they said, well, gee, no system's perfect. And you, along with other guests on Coast, have convinced me that there is no such thing as an impenetrable firewall. I tell people I don't want to become naked roadkill on the information superhighway, and I'm one of those few who still don't have a computer because of that information. And now pretty much PG&E, Pacific Gas and Electric, is forcing us to get smart meters, which I'm concerned the vulnerability can allow people to detect when you're not home, what, maybe even what kind of electronic equipment you have based on energy consumption and what they might find in there when you're not home, along with the whole idea of the grid going down from a cyber attack from outside of our country. And I'd like your take on that.
Well, there's a brilliant security researcher by the name of Joe Grand, and you might want to Google him because he has done talks at the security conferences, Black Hat and DEF CON, on vulnerabilities of smart meters that was pretty impressive. So I would encourage you to go read his research, and it'll be sure to answer all your questions.
Okay, great. Next up, we go to Ken in Whidbey Island, Washington. Hey, Kenny, go ahead.
Hey, George, have I got you?
Go ahead.
I can't hear you at all. I can't really hear.
Okay. Well, in that case, we got to move on. Let's go to Sherman Oaks, California. Hey, Carlos, welcome to the show.
Hey, great to speak with you both. Kevin, I was meant to ask you, what would you figure would be the downside of facial recognition software? Also, did you call personal message system in the 80s back in the day, and did you know Dave Compell or Steve Rhodes?
Oh, I know Dave Compell and I know Steve Rhodes. Their names are actually in Ghost in the Wires. And downside of facial recognition, well, I don't think it's really involved. Facial recognition technology has really evolved to, I guess, a breaking point, if you will. And a downside of it, I don't know. I mean, maybe you could think about a society like Blade Runner. I don't know. It's probably, I guess, you know, technology is a tool, and it could be used for good or it could be used for evil, right?
No doubt. What's happening technologically, Kevin, with computers? Remember the old saying that they change every 2 years, they speed up, they speed
Moore's
up?
Law.
Yeah. Is that still happening?
Yeah. I mean, computers are getting faster. New applications. You know, technology is evolving, and I think it's a wonderful thing. Of course, the downside is complexity, and when you have complexity, you know, there's always security flaws that are identified. But I love it. I mean, I use computers for my daily work, you know, obviously breaking into them. So, I mean, without computers, I'd be out of a job.
You sure would. Julian is in Abilene, Texas, and you're on Coast to Coast. Go ahead, Julian.
Hi. Kevin, I've been following you for a really, really long time. And one thing I've always wondered is, has anybody from the like Markov or any of the early writers who wrote about you, to the prosecutor who convinced the judge that you could whistle up missile launch codes, or the judge who believed it, or anybody who's over-exaggerated you to such this extent, has anybody apologized or said sorry or been a retraction or anything like that?
No, in fact, recently I have Twitter. I have a Twitter account, and if anyone's interested in following me, it's it's twitter.com/KevinMitnick. And I recently had a dialogue with John Markov because I made a comment because the New York Times just did a book review of Ghost in the Wires. So I made like a kind of a smart-ass comment. Well, you know, I don't understand. They did a book review, and it wasn't on the front page. And the last time, you know, the last three times I was in the New York Times, I was on the front page. So it was a jokingly comment. And Markov actually follows me. And then he said, well, it probably has to do with the writing. And then I responded to him. I said, let bygones be bygones.
Yeah.
And I said, by the way, you would make a great fictional writer because you have a great imagination. So then everything just stopped. But no, it's kind of like everyone went their own way. And it's in the past.
Are the people who are hacking today, is anybody helping them? Anybody training them?
Probably nation states or even our own U.S. government. I'm sure they probably have schools, you know, that train people in exploitation techniques. Or probably better yet is recently last month, or, you know, the beginning of this month, I'm sorry, is at the DEF CON security conference in Vegas. There was an amazing turnout of, I think, of like 14,000 people. And actually the government agencies were allegedly there recruiting hackers as talent. So
getting the best of the best.
Are these guys being used for the offense or the defense? Who knows?
Who would be better hackers? Is there a better country?
I don't think you could really classify by country. Of course, we all hear about China, how they're very adept at getting into our systems. But I really think it comes down to the skills of the people rather than a culture.
Next up, we go to the Bronx. Hey, Joe, welcome to the show. Did you feel a rumble, Joe?
Yes, I definitely did. I felt the rumble under my feet. I was standing in a hall at the time of my apartment, and it was about 1:51, 1:52 p.m. Definitely did know what it was immediately.
Weird feeling, isn't it?
Earthquake.
Yeah.
Oh, totally, totally. George, I wanted to ask Kevin about the possibility of these bank employees and customer service reps over the phone, whether they can tap into a customer's account and, you know, do some funky stuff, you know, sort of like switch funds from a customer's account to an account that they set up themselves, and whether, you know, banks are equipped to have these security measures in place to monitor or prevent that from happening?
Yeah, probably big banks have they have checks and balances for tellers. And, of course, telephone bankers, unfortunately, have access to customer credentials, which I was surprised. So when you call, like if you call Chase, for example, and you want to work with your account over the phone, I think this was with Wells and Bank of America, too, is they ask you for your password. Well, the telephone banker actually sees your password because they look it up, and if it matches, they help you. You know, of course, these guys are in the position of looking up, you know, customers, you know, passwords, and could get their identifiers to authenticate as them over the telephone. So certainly there's a risk there. That's why they probably put people under stringent background checks that get hired by these financial institutions. But as far as, like, going, you know, in the branch doing wire transfers from their own computer, per se, I think there's enough checks and balances that will probably catch them. But if they take this information outside the bank and sell it to the underground, that it could be leveraged for evil.
Do you still dabble in magic?
Oh, I love magic. I went to a magic show tonight. I went to see a guy named Aaron Rabin who performed at the Planet Hollywood. And what's kind of funny is he's actually a security director for Google. So so a lot of people that are in security are also fans of magic. And that's what I love about living in Las Vegas, because the people I hang out with are usually magicians.
Yeah, that's cool. Have you been to Copperfield's show?
Oh, yeah, I have. I'm still trying to figure out how he makes the car appear. If anybody knows, please email me.
It's amazing. And even Chris Angel, he's pretty good too, isn't he?
I haven't seen his show, but I actually heard bad things about his show.
The production of the show was bad. He's good, but I mean, he had like people dressed up as rabbits and things, and it just didn't work.
Yeah, but he has a sweet deal. He got paid $200 million for that gig.
$200 million. He's at the Luxor.
Million, yeah. So he's making the big bucks. He could afford a MacBook Pro now.
Let's go to Santa Rosa, California to talk to Anonymous. There you go.
Well, thank you, George.
Sure.
Hey, are you wearing a Guy Fawkes mask?
I had a quick question for you about, I was listening to a show last week. They had people that were involved in three of the different actions with this, and it seems that some of the messages by the advocates themselves is getting lost. And a case in point would be the BART protest in San Francisco. There's a woman, LaMisha. Her son was shot 48 times by 9 San Francisco policemen. She started a police accountability foundation 10 years ago with the money from the wrongful death. And she was trying to bring out the information about steroid abuse by law enforcement, where most of these guys, 95% of them are great guys. It's the 5% they found were responsible for over 50% of the cases of police abuse,
mm-hmm.
So it's a minority. And with that, there's the steroid abuse with the law enforcement and what happens when they go to make a split-second decision. So she was she started the foundation. His name is actually the Idris Stelly Foundation in San Francisco. But it seems like that entire message got lost when the cell phones were turned off. Nothing's being done. The citizens here are outraged because it's just an inconvenience. And Anonymous isn't going after the core problem. It's like when you're up to your butt in alligators, it's kind of hard to remember. Your main objective is to drain the swamp, and it's these steroids. I was wondering what your take was on the way this is evolving with Anonymous, and how do you get the word out to these kids? Listen to your elders. Misha has something to say to you about this.
Geez, I don't really know how to answer the question. I've been following it too with Bart turning off the cell phone.
Yeah, that was crazy.
I don't agree with them turning off the cell phone service. But you know, then again, I believe Anonymous hacked into a server and exposed information of people that weren't even involved in the dispute, which is kind of weird. You know, I could understand if they were attacking the direct parties, but you know, it's kind of like a collateral damage type of thing. You know, maybe they could find a better way to communicate their displeasure with what's going on. So I haven't really been following it all that closely, the BART case, because I'm actually in Vegas. I don't live in San Francisco. So only read bits and pieces of it.
How long have you been in Vegas?
Since 2003.
Okay, so most of our interviews, that's where you were, huh?
Exactly, and I travel a lot. I'm like hardly here, and I grew up in Los Angeles, and I have some family here in Vegas, so that's why I'm in town. But I'm usually on the road 70 to 80% of the time.
But you're based in Vegas most of the time.
I'm based in Vegas, yeah.
Okay.
It's kind of funny because I'd figure if I'm in Vegas, I'd have a lot of the casinos as clients. But
you would think.
Yeah, you would think, but most of my clients are outside of Nevada. So It's interesting.
Let's go to Houston, Texas. First-time caller. Name Low-Tech. Is that really your name?
No, actually, I got it from a movie called Johnny Mnemonic.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Anonymous just doesn't sound right to me. But anyway, Kevin, is it legal to modify firmware?
To modify what?
Firmware.
Yeah. I suppose. I don't know if there's anything to do with the DMCA.
What's a DMCA, Kevin? Speak English now.
I'm sorry. The Digital Millennium Copyright Act that, you know, forbids reverse engineering, you know, products and stuff. It's a federal crime. So because I'm not really up with the law, I don't really know. I don't think it really stops anybody from, you know, modifying firmware, but I don't know the legalities of it nowadays.
When you were just doing this, they didn't have any laws at all, did they?
No, when I started hacking, there was no laws on the books. And then the first federal computer crime law was passed in 1984. And then, of course, you know, those have also evolved as well. But of course, there's a crime called wire fraud. So if you make an interstate phone call in the furtherance of fraud, they could prosecute you under that, and that law has been on the books for years. So that's how they used to prosecute people that were using blue boxes to make free phone calls.
Ah, let's go to Corey, truck driving in Tennessee, east of the Rockies. Hey, Corey, go ahead.
All right, I want to suggest a company that you might want to seek out, and I'm going to tell you why. I was talking to another truck driver, and he said that countries like China don't have no use in going after NORAD or, you know, anything like that, when all they have to do is go after Qualcomm. Qualcomm controls 60 to 75% of every truck in North America, not anywhere else in the world. You could shut down pretty much all commerce with the stroke of a mouse if you could get into them. That'd be a company that I'd want to protect.
Well, I hope they're protecting them now.
Yeah, in fact, I actually hacked into Qualcomm back in 1993. Their cellular phone development division, I wasn't prosecuted for it, but the government knew about it.
Good point, so, Corey. Maybe let's hope they're beefing things up. That's going to be
since 1993, let's hope.
Interesting indeed. Kevin, get your website out, please. Go ahead.
Website is www.mitnicksecurity.com. That's MITNICK security.com. You could also go to www.ghostinthewires.com. And I hope that people could solve these cryptograms. There's already been a handful of people that have already been successful, and I'm curious of how many people will be able to do it.
All right, Kevin, thank you so much. For Dan Galante, Paul Mahler, Will Wilkerson, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesour, Stephanie Smith, Ross Mitchell, George Nappy, and Punnett and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.